Just in time for Mother's Day, Hometown Heroes focuses on one of the more than 350,000 women who served in our armed forces during World War II.
We broke the ice for women, joined this auxiliary corps, and then proved to the government that we could do the job and that we weren't relegated to the kitchen sink.
She sure wasn't. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join me for this 93-year-old's unique story on Hometown Heroes, today at 1 on News Talk 580 or at 5 p.m. on FM 105.9 KMJ.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on KMJ, whether you listen to us at 1 o'clock on the AM side, 5 o'clock on FM 105.9, or anytime at kmjnow.com online. You know that each week we catch up with World War II veterans, and we want to honor them for their service, their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten, and so the rest of us can learn a thing or two about what life was like back then and what it's like to really love your country. We're going to get that today from 93-year-old Hilda Johnson. Every time Mother's Day rolls around, I like to make sure that we get a woman veteran of World War II. Yes, women were very involved in World War II, not just in uniform, but on the home front as well. Hilda wore a couple uniforms, including one that didn't quite catch on, and she's going to tell us that story. She lives here at Carrington Point. If you want to come join us next Saturday, May 19th, all of our KMJ programming from 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. will originate from Carrington Point Retirement Community on Alluvial, just east of Cedar in North Fresno. It'll be an open house with tours, plenty of free food, and you can get the details on their free Veterans Benefit Seminar coming up this month. I'll be out there from 1 to 2, and you can catch Craig Hansen and the Real Talk and Auto Shop Talk Cruise too. That's next Saturday at Carrington Point. Hilda's been here for a couple of years now. She's been on this earth for 93 years, and the early years were in Iowa, from what I understand. Now tell me this story. You came across from Iowa all the way to California in a Model T Ford when you were 8 years old?
Yes, our family moved from Iowa to Fresno because my father came out here and went to work for PG&E. So we drove out in two Model T Ford touring cars. Two uncles came with us. Each one drove one of the cars. And we stayed in campgrounds overnight and took it in a motor trip all the way to California. It took us about a week to make it.
I guess so, and that had to be quite the adventure for a young girl. What was Fresno like in 1926?
It was so small, we could see the Pacific Southwest building from our house when we lived out near McKinley on Highway 99. There was nothing there. And one day we went out to Pinedale to visit the lumber company, and we stopped halfway out for a rest period because it was so far from home, from downtown Fresno.
Different times. The place has grown a little bit since then. So you grew up here in Fresno, and you're already a young lady of 23 years old when Pearl Harbor happened. What do you remember about that day, December 7th, 1941? Do you remember how you heard that America was under attack?
It came on the radio, and we were all stunned, of course, and just almost unbelievable. Couldn't believe that it was happening. And when they found out it was from Japan, the people in Fresno all became very feared of the Japanese people living here because the Japanese people were rather exclusive. They stayed to themselves. They weren't social like the rest of us. And so because of that, we didn't know them, and we were frightened.
And I'm sure in the years since, you've probably heard a lot of Japanese Americans tell their stories. They were pretty frightened at the time, too.
Yes, they were. They were very frightened. But they wonder why we treated them so terrible. Well, it was fear. The people were so frightened, and they didn't know what to do, and they knew they had to do something and do it fast.
Now, most of the veterans that I interview are male, as you might imagine. Most of the veterans, the lion's share of them in World War II, were male. And so they all pretty much knew that they were going to be involved somehow in uniform. How did you end up wearing a WAC uniform?
Well, I kept thinking, what can we do to bring this war to an end soon, so our fellows won't be gone so long? Because we had already had studies of World War I and in our minds. And so I kept thinking, well, the only thing I could become a Rosie the Riveter. But at that time, there weren't such things as Rosie the Riveter. When the Army, they passed the law making the Women's Army, it was the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps. I decided that if more women joined and we took the desk jobs, that it would end the war that much sooner. So the main reason for joining was to help bring the war to an end quicker.
It wasn't to meet a handsome man in uniform?
Heavens no, we were there to serve our country, not anybody else.
Well, and I think a lot of people don't really know how much that women did in World War II. And on this program over the years, we've heard from women who were in the Waves, women who were in the Coast Guard spars, women who served in the Wasps as pilots during the war. What did it mean to be a WAC, and how hard was the training? Did they break you in a little bit?
What it meant is that, as we didn't realize until later, that we were the pioneers. We were the first group that was formed, the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps. We were not part of any military per se, because it was an auxiliary corps. And then we had basic training like anyone else, other branches of the service. And then we proved that we could do the job. And then when the Washington realized that we were doing the job, that's when they dropped the auxiliary and let us, after a couple of years, they made us Women's Army Corps. We were in the Army, but it was a special army, the Women's Army Corps. And then after the end of the war, they realized that what a good job we had done, and not that we're bragging, but we were successful in what we did. They dropped the Army and made us regular Army, part of the United States Army.
When was it that you got in to the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps?
1942, about shortly after when it was first formed. A couple of months, we went to Fort Des Moines, Iowa for our training, and I was in one of the early companies, not the first or second, but about the third or fourth company that went there for training.
When you talk about that training, was any of that really tough for you? Was any of it kind of made you say, well, I don't know if I'm cut out for this or not?
No, it wasn't tough because they kept us so busy we didn't have time to even think about it. And we did basic training, like close order drill and military training, but we did spend a lot of time in classrooms learning Army procedure, learning all the paperwork, in other words.
And when they actually incorporated the WAC into the regular Army, was that something you were happy about? Did it make you feel like you were accepted as part of this grander war effort, or were you disappointed?
I was very proud of the fact that we were pioneers, that we did lay the groundwork and did prove that we could do the job. However, I was already out of the service then. It was after the war was over when we became of the regular Army. Before that, I was still in the Women's Army Corps, the WAC.
Now, I've seen some pictures here, and we'll put some pictures up at kmjnow.com. A couple different uniforms that you got to wear. But there's a really good story with the one of them. This white uniform. Now, I haven't seen that uniform too much because in the history of the WACs, you're not really pictured in that white top and skirt. But how did you come to wear that, and what was this whole idea?
It was a white, off-white uniform with a zipper fly front, short sleeves, and a white hat that matched. It was not pure white, it was off-white. It was washable and didn't require ironing. And the Women's Army Corps was planning to make this off-white uniform the official WAC uniform. I was one of six women in the United States who modeled this uniform for about approximately 4 or 5 weeks. I traveled through New York State and took a train trip to California and back wearing this uniform. I would seek out public opinion of the uniform. I would send a report of these opinions to Washington, D.C. every night after I'd leave the hotel. I'd run mail this into the Washington. The uniform received 100% approval. It was accepted and set for production. However, at that time, the Congress voted to disband the WAC, the Women's Army Corps, and make us part of the regular Army. The regular Army rejected the uniform as the uniform of the regular Army. So, and the regular Army said no, they didn't want it because they wanted the women's uniforms to match as possibly the regular khaki Army uniforms. And that was not made part of the regular Army, but it would have been our uniform if we had not joined the regular Army, if they had not dropped the A out of it. Out of the women's auxiliary.
And so this uniform, I mean, I would say is a little more feminine, a little more elegant. It does not look like just any other man wearing a uniform. It's very clear that you're a woman when you're wearing this white skirt and the white top. Were you disappointed that after all that work, that uniform wasn't accepted?
Well, yes, we were disappointed, but I didn't consider it work. It was a pleasure.
That's the question. How do you get a job like that? How did they pick you as one of just a handful of women to model this uniform?
I had the figure and the body that would fit the uniform, I guess. All I know is I was working in Albany, New York, and this uniform came from Washington, D.C., mailed to me. They knew what I looked like and what size I wore, and I put it on, wore it. It fit perfectly.
And what had you been doing there to that point? What kind of jobs were you doing?
We worked out of a recruiting office, but we had limited a number of people that we could take into the Army Corps. So most of our efforts were helping sell bonds at bond rallies. So I attended bond rallies, and it was just public relations, pushing the Army and encouraging people to join, and mainly selling bonds and attending bond rallies everywhere.
And for people that weren't alive back then, I don't think they understand this atmosphere that was around then. I mean, we really, as a country, knew we had to pay for what we were going to do overseas. And you folks back home selling those bonds, without you, then there wouldn't have been the money to produce all the tanks and airplanes and win the war.
Yes, and I was surprised recently when I told a young lady that I went to bond rallies, and she said, "What is a bond rally?" And I had to explain it was where they sold government bonds to pay, get the money to pay for what the military needed to win the war.
And I, from what I've heard, and I've talked to a few people that were engaged in this, I guess it was a lot easier to sell the bonds when you had some pretty young women out there selling them.
Well, I don't know about that because I wasn't on that side of the fence.
But you were helping to sell them.
I hope so.
And you weren't the only one. Quite a few Hollywood stars and even the Looney Tunes. Let's go into the archives here. I can't show it to you on the radio, of course, but let's see if you recognize the famous voice encouraging people to buy war bonds on this recording courtesy of Warner Brothers.
The tall man with a high hat and a whiskers on his chin will soon be knocking at your door, and you ought to be in. The tall man with the high hat will be coming down your way. Get your savings out when you hear him shout, any bonds today? Come on and get them, folks. Come on, skip right up and get them. Any bonds today? Bonds of freedom, that's what I'm selling. Any bonds today? Scrape up the most you can. Here comes the freedom man, asking you to buy your share of freedom today. Many stamps today, give kitties, we'll be blessed, we all invest in the USA. Sammy, my Uncle Sammy,
here comes the freedom man.
Can't make tomorrow's plan,
not unless you buy a share of freedom today.
And nothing like Bugs Bunny, Elmer Fudd, and Porky Pig in three-part harmony to talk you into buying war bonds. Hilda Johnson was part of that effort, too. And when we come back, she'll tell us which legendary musician she once shared the stage with. Don't forget to come out and meet her next Saturday at Carrington Point. And don't go anywhere. More of Hometown Heroes after we hear from our sponsors, starting with Fresno Distributing.
It's as simple as ABC, Fresno T.
I can remember hearing that jingle on the radio for years, but I didn't really understand what it meant until redoing my shower a couple years ago. This is Paul Leffler, proud to welcome Fresno Distributing as a sponsor of Hometown Heroes here on KMJ. The knucklehead who tiled my shower, that would be yours truly, left a decent-sized hole around the shower arm. I needed an oversized flange to cover it, and I went all over town. None of the chain stores had what I needed. Finally, a merciful soul asked me, "Have you tried Fresno D?" Fresno D, as in duh, why didn't I think of that in the first place? So I quickly took the 41 of the McKinley exit, walked into Fresno Distributing, and bumped smack dab into the owner, Steve Cloud. He said he was sure they had exactly what I needed, and of course, he was right. Now I make Fresno D my first stop, whether I'm looking for one of those obscure plumbing parts or a top-of-the-line appliance, like the new Electrolux energy-efficient washer and dryer set my wife picked out. They have all the other top brands, too. Don't make the mistake I did. If you want your first stop to be your last stop, make a beeline for Fresno D. And while you're there, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes on KMJ. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and Advanced Placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the Valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Tomorrow's Mother's Day, and if that's the first you've heard of it, you've got trouble. Our guest today is a mother of two, grandmother of five, and great-grandmother to three little ones. 93-year-old Hilda Johnson is one of the more than 350,000 women who served in the U.S. Armed Forces during World War II. She was in the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps, later the Women's Army Corps, and as she told us, Hilda was one of just half a dozen to model what was proposed to be a new uniform for the WAC. So you get this package on your desk, and you try on the uniform, and it fits perfectly. Did you have any kind of training for being a model of this new uniform that was trying to find acceptance?
Well, prior to that, we had I was with a group that had temporary duty in New York City. We had concentrated public event happenings. Prior to this 30-day service, they sent us to the Harry Conover Modeling School for a crash course, an 8-hour crash course in modeling. And I guess that's where they found out what size I wore. But that was interesting because we attended bond rallies in New York City for 30 days. Or we would go to a department store and sit in a booth and answer questions all day long. And plus a lot of interesting things. Went to a recording of the Fred Waring Orchestra in a theater one night. And they told me to go there at 8:05. And I got there at 8:05 and they said, "We're sold out, we can't let you in." And so I said, "But I have a ticket." And so the man said, "Let me see if I can find you a seat. I'll be right back." And so he left and came back. And he said, "I found you a seat." So it was down in the front, the third row from the front. And we walked 5 minutes before the concert was going to start. We slowly walked down the aisle, got down there, and there was a man sitting in the seat. He saw us coming. He jumped up, went out an exit, and then they seated me in that seat. That's when I realized this was all arranged in advance so that everybody in the theater could see that uniform that I was wearing and see a military person coming in.
They wanted you to have a grand entrance so everybody noticed.
Another time, I attended the last concert of the Glenn Miller put on a bond rally concert in Utica, New York. And on the stage, in a riser behind the band, they had a person from each branch of the service, and I was on the stage representing the Women's Army Corps. And this was his last concert before he left the United States, went to England, put on one concert in England, I was told, and then his plane was lost over the English Channel shortly after that. But it was such a thrill to be on the stage with the Glenn Miller band and sitting there watching it and be part of it.
And that uniform that you were wearing was, you could call that color pearl. Were you wearing a string of pearls when Glenn Miller was up there playing String of Pearls?
No, but we really wanted to dance to it. But we had to sit still and behave ourselves.
It sounds like this, and I think you mentioned this earlier, this was a pretty fun assignment. How much responsibility did you feel, though, to, I guess, be on guard, put out a positive image to the public and feel like you were representing something bigger than yourself?
Well, we knew that we had to give a good image to the public. So we had to really, really behave ourselves. And we traveled in small towns everywhere and we were pushing the Army. And how could you push the Army if we weren't behaving ourselves? But I enjoyed everywhere I went. I was treated royally. The public always gave us a big welcome. And it was I spoke to service clubs like Lions, Rotary, and people like that to assure them that it was safe to be in the Army. It was okay for women to be in the Army because they told us at all times we must be a lady. And we weren't even allowed to wear slacks. We had to wear a dress or a skirt at all times. And another time they said, "Don't ever, ever be caught or get a picture taken holding a gun." We couldn't even touch a gun because we were women. We were not the combat soldiers. And so that was stressed that to be a lady, behave yourself.
And it's interesting how different that is these days, but it is the work that you and those other women did all those years ago that paved the way for the opportunities that women have today. How do you feel about that?
Well, I don't think women should be in the combat area. I'll be very honest about that. And I know now I saw the paper where they're going to consider letting women go into combat. And I don't think it's fair to the male soldiers that are in there to be distracted. I'm sure they would be by women in the trenches with them. So I don't believe in that. I think that there's enough to do in the background, in the behind the scenes that we could do to help any war effort. And most of us did in World War II. But the majority of the women that joined all joined for patriotic reasons. They all wanted the war to end, and this is why we joined. We didn't join to have fun or to look for a boyfriend or anything else. It was strictly the political, because we felt proud of our country and we wanted the war to over, get over with and go home so we could be mothers and raise our families.
And you are a mother to two, a grandmother to five, a great-grandmother to three. And I guess you had the patriotic reasons, obviously, for being in. And you also had some personal reasons that it would be good for you and your family if the war ended sooner. You weren't the only one of your siblings who was wearing a uniform during World War II. Who else was?
I had a brother in the Air Force and a brother in the Navy, and then me, the three of us. My mother was very proud, and so was my father. They told us that when we left, like when I left, they said, don't forget, whatever you do, no matter whatever happens to you, you can always come back home here, where you'll always have a home. And that was nice to know, that I was out protecting my own home.
And it sounds like you felt that because of your work and the more women doing jobs that otherwise would have to be performed by men, the more men could be overseas, and the quicker your two brothers could come home from the Air Corps and the Navy?
That's true. And this was, I was made aware of this when I was in Washington, D.C. at the dedication of the Women's Memorial. I met a female Army Air Force captain who was a pilot in an airplane. And she talked to me a long time about being in the service. And she stood back and she said, I want to salute you because you women who joined in the very beginning were the pioneers that broke the ice and made it possible for us to be what we're doing today. As an Air Force pilot.
And I want to talk to you about that dedication 15 years ago there at Arlington for the memorial for the women in service for America. But let's talk a little bit more about World War II. You mentioned men can be distracted by women. Were there ever any distractions from your job when you were trying to be out there and wear that uniform proudly and spread the news that you were asked to spread? Did anybody ever get in your way or distract you or heckle you or anything like that?
No, not really. They did respect us everywhere we went. And if we did have a suitor to come to us, we had to sort of cool it, keep it cool and say no. The women who did not say no were the exception.
But somewhere along the way in your time in uniform, you met a kindly Kansas farm boy who caught your attention somehow?
Oh, yes. I met him at a dance in Times Square at the Roseland Ballroom in New York City. And I knew him just 30 days, and he was being shipped out to Guadalcanal. And he begged me to marry him, and I'd only knew him 30 days. And I said no, so he went on over there and then mailed me an engagement ring in the mail, hoping I would accept it. And so then when the war ended, we were married and moved to Fresno.
Well, that's the nutshell version, but it didn't unfold that quickly for you. I'm sure there were a lot of nervous days wondering if he was going to come home, how things were going to play out. What do you remember about that time period?
Well, we watched and listened to the news every day. And the biggest thing in my mind is the day the war ended, the day they dropped the bomb on Japan. And I'll never forget that, that day and how we learned that news.
Tell me about it. Where were you?
I was working at a separation center in Fort Dix, New Jersey. And we were about six or seven of us were in one room, each at our desk working. And one of the men had a radio on, and he finally yelled at everybody, listen, come over here and listen to this radio. So we all went over and listened. We heard they had dropped the bomb, and we heard the reports coming in. And nobody screamed or yelled or danced or jumped up and down. Everyone stood in perfect still in perfect silence and just stared into space. They couldn't believe it, and there was silence in the room. All we could hear was that radio. And finally, one of the men said, in a very calm, soft voice, the war is over. And everybody stood there again for a few seconds and turned around and didn't say one word and went back to their desk and sat down and attempted to get some work done. But there was silence. We were so stunned that the war was over and now we could go home, that we weren't dancing in the street or anything like that or screaming and yelling hooray. They just couldn't believe the war was over. And it really, really was very impressive.
And what did that mean to you personally?
Personally? Well, I'll never forget when I got my discharge, we were in a chapel. As we got ready to leave, the organist played Sentimental Journey. And so everyone stopped in the track and froze, and the women started crying because it was going to be a sentimental journey back home. Then I stopped and realized, oh my gosh, now I have to buy my own railroad ticket and make my own reservations. Nobody's going to do it for me.
And had you been corresponding with your husband-to-be while he was overseas?
Oh, yes. He would send me all kinds of letters and keep me informed of what was going on. And he was in the Coast Guard, but they went in after the original Marine attack because they built the equipment and the radar towers. They built the construction. They had to build, they called them sonar, And they built those so that the Air Force could come in to drop their bombs. So they were in right after the first Marines that went in. He was on Iwo Jima, and they had to work all day during the day building these towers that at night they had to sleep with their clothes on, with their rifle by their bed, because they had snipers sneak onto their island every night. And when the snipers came in, somebody would blow a whistle, and then men would all have to jump out of bed, grab their rifle, run out and look for the snipers during the night, come back, go back to bed, not to go back, lay down and sleep, and then build up and work on construction during the day. So it wasn't easy. And this was the Coast Guard, so they can't say that the Coast Guard had it easy, because they didn't all have it soft.
No doubt. And we've had plenty of Coast Guard veterans on this program who have told us how severe the circumstances were they faced. And, you know, we're getting your own story as a veteran of World War II, serving as a woman during that time period, a trailblazer for women. But I'm also interested, as someone who is waiting for this man to come home for the war, did you ever lie awake at night and say, what if he doesn't come home? Did you ever consider the possibility that he might not be back to make that engagement final?
Oh, yes. You thought of that many, many times. But you just dwell on it. You just kept on with your life. You had to go on and do your job, because we had a job to do, and we were doing it. And we couldn't let our personal feelings keep us from what we were doing.
And something tells me if you agreed to marry him after only knowing him for 30 days, that you probably didn't wait too long once he actually got home.
Well, that was his desire. He wouldn't take no for an answer. So we got married then.
Was it emotional to see him again after he was that far away? You were doing what you were doing, and you never knew what was going to happen?
Well, yes, it was. The interesting thing was, as soon as he got back, he landed in Manhattan Beach in Los Angeles in California. And he wired me a bouquet of flowers. Can you imagine wiring? I was then stationed at Fort Dix, New Jersey. He sent a bouquet of flowers to an Army cap, and there's no way the Army cap would even accept the delivery, so I never did get the flowers.
I'm always struck by the uncertainty that everyone felt, because we can look back in history now and say, okay, the war ended in August of 1945, and everybody lived happily ever after, but you never knew what was going to happen. So how special was it to actually see him again and to realize that you really did have this future for because that was never a given, that you would have that kind of future and that kind of freedom?
Well, that is true. I'll never forget not knowing about their future. I was in New York City on a leave one weekend, and they had a blackout in New York City. You could imagine New York City with no lights on everywhere. Everything was off because it was rumored that a German sub had landed on the beach in Connecticut, which later turned out to be true. It really happened. And so all the East Coast cities had to go on blackout. All the lights were out. And that's when I sat in the hotel room in the darkness thinking, oh, my gosh, what if they drop a bomb on New York? And knowing the uncertainty of all of it. But then you just have to say, well, go with the flow.
And you're still going with the flow at age 93. Another thing about being the spouse of someone who had served in World War II and did see action overseas, as your husband did, is it something that he told you much about when he got home, or did he really keep it to himself?
He didn't share it too often, no, because it was not very nice, because they were in a landing ship, one of those little ships that let go on shore landing ship, and the Japanese suicide pilots were bombing them. And their little craft was unloading on the beach, and a ship came in that was going to bomb them. And he said the plane was so low they could see the pilot's face, and he was grimacing. And so instead of dropping a bomb on them, he peeled off and came back, circled around, and got the little ship next to him, because it was loaded with men, and their ship was empty. And so he said that's the only thing that saved his life. Then their crew people on their little boat had to spend their time rescuing the other soldiers that they were caught in the water in covered with oil that was burning. And he said that was the most horrible nightmarish thing. Years later, he would not forget it, and he would dream about it, because they had to try to save these people out of this burning oil all over on water. And Russia physically carried them to medical treatment. And so that was the hardest part for him, and he didn't talk about that for a long time. And then finally he did talk about it and got it out of his system, and then we put it out of our mind. That was something to forget about.
Well, and I think that's important to discuss, because I think a lot of people don't realize, A, what people did back then, what they went through, but what kind of toll it took on them for a long time. And it sounds like you experienced that in a very real way.
Well, earlier I mentioned that at night they had to jump out of bed, go look for the snipers. So after we were married for many nights, sometimes he would wake up in the I would wake up in the middle of the night, and he'd be patting me on my shoulder saying, you're okay. And he would jump out of bed, hit the floor, and stand up, and then realize he was home and that the war was over. But he was still dreaming that he was jumping out of bed going for the snipers. And he was always assuring, patting me, saying, you're okay. In his sleep, you know, he was dreaming. So it did take its toll on him.
People today, and I know that you've told your story. You've participated in the Oral History Project at Fresno State. You've worked with the Stories of Service group here, the high school students documenting stories. Why do you think it's important that young people today know what people like you and your husband did during World War II? Why do we need to know about that these days?
Well, they need to know that we valued our country and our freedom and to do whatever is possible to prevent any kind of conflict, any wars at all, because it's not very nice, not very pleasant, but it's something that we have to do if we're going to preserve our way of life.
Amen. And you were a part of that in World War II. We need to step away for another break, but we'll hear from Hilda about a special experience she had more than 50 years after World War II when Hometown Heroes continues after some more from our sponsors like Fresno Distributing.
What do you think of when I say Fresno D? Probably that catchy little jingle, right?
It's as simple as ABC, Fresno D.
Paul Leffler here to tell you what it means to me. It means Fresno Distributing selection of top-of-the-line appliances at wholesale prices for you, me, and everybody means you don't have to go anywhere else.
Since I started hosting Bulldog Coaches shows in Fresno D's showroom a few years back, I've gotten to know the owner, Steve Cloud, quite well. I know that some of his favorites are King Tut, Coca-Cola with real sugar in it, and of course, the Bulldogs. I know not to challenge him in gin rummy because he's a former world champion, no joke. But the other thing I know, and here's why my wife and I picked out our new Electrolux washer and dryer there, I know the Cloud family has been carrying the best appliances you can find anywhere since 1946. Bosch, Frigidaire, Maytag, JennAir, KitchenAid, Wolf, you name it. They have it. Don't just take my word for it. Go see for yourself at Fresno Distributing on McKinley between Blackstone and 41. Plumbing, lighting, electrical, kitchen, bath, whatever you need, Fresno D has it. And you won't find friendlier or more knowledgeable service anywhere. A locally owned business with great prices, great selection, and great service. Why go anywhere else? Still as simple as ABC. Fresno D.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while, so next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. It's been a pleasure on the eve of Mother's Day to visit with a 93-year-old great-grandma who served in the Women's Army Corps in World War II. We've learned a lot from Hilda Johnson, and here's another question for you, Hilda. What do you take the most pride in being able to call yourself a World War II veteran?
For me, it's because we broke the ice for women and joined this auxiliary corps and then proved to the government that we could do the job and that we weren't relegated to the kitchen sink.
And I'm sure that one day that stands out in your memory was there in 1997 when you went back to Arlington National Cemetery and they dedicated that memorial, Women in Service for America. What was that day like? How big was that crowd, and how special was it for you to be there?
It was very special for me because my friend and I that went with me, we had made our reservations early, so we had good seats up front where we could see all the dignitaries, and there were approximately 43,000 people there on that area between the river and the memorial at Arlington Cemetery in Washington, D.C. So that was very, very impressive. And then we went back later for a memorial there, which was very impressive, and because it was after dark, and we walked across the bridge carrying candles and walked to the Arlington Cemetery, came up into the cemetery. Right outside the memorial, there's a water reflecting basin, a little shallow water pond. And at every Memorial Day, they read the names of the women who passed away. And with the, as each name is read, they throw a rose petal into that water, that floating water. It's very impressive. And that night, we did this ceremony. They put, as they read the names. And we sat beside Janet Reno then, who was, I think, Attorney General or something. And there were dignitaries from Washington, D.C. there, which were very nice. And so it was a thrill to get to sit with those people and to talk to them. It took the women veterans in the United States 10 years to raise enough money to match the government's money to build that memorial. It was there and it was vacant, and they didn't know what to do with it, and nobody wanted to do anything with it, none of the veterans groups. So what an army, female army general said, the women will take it, we'll raise the money, and we'll do something if you'll give it to us. So they did. And now it's a beautiful women's memorial in Washington, D.C.
And what does it signify to you when you were there looking at it, when you see a picture of it today? What does it make you think of?
It made me think women are worth something after all.
Did anyone ever question that?
Well, women didn't always had a role of second best, you know, salary-wise and job-wise and all. We had to, like I said, we were relegated to being a mother and working in the kitchen and washing clothes and washing dishes and cooking.
Well, it is Mother's Day coming up, and you are a mother, and I'm curious, when your kids were growing up, did you ever talk about your days as a WAC and tell them some of the stories about what you did?
Not really. It was I felt I wasn't a hero. I was just one of a group that worked to preserve what we had, our way of life. But they did know that I was in the service because I joined veterans groups and was very active there. In fact, I'm kind of proud to say I was a national representative for 2 years, once for the Women's Army Corps, met with the Veterans Administration and out of Washington, D.C., every 3 months somewhere in the United States, and planned activities for the veterans' hospitals and veterans' affairs. That was an honor to have that job, and so I really did enjoy doing that. And then I volunteered, as soon as I quit work, I volunteered for the Veterans Hospital. And that was very, very rewarding. And I would certainly recommend that to anybody who doesn't know what to do with your life. Go volunteer, especially at a hospital. The Veterans Hospital was so rewarding, and it was so worthwhile to be a volunteer there.
Have you ever had people react funny when you tell them that you were in uniform in World War II? Do you ever run into people who don't believe you or think you're making something up?
Well, what the biggest thing that happens is, how many boyfriends did you have? That it was a misnomer. We did not have boyfriends. We weren't there to look for a boyfriend. We were there to do a job. And we did work along with them. And as far as I was concerned, they were the same as my brothers. I grew up with three brothers, and I know what it was like to be around men, and they didn't bother me.
When you tell people about what you did in the war, and you talk to other veterans, and you spend time thinking about that time in our history that was so crucial and has given us the situation and the freedom that we have today, what do you think is important for us to know today, for those of us who weren't around? What should we know about World War II and why so many millions of you Americans at the time did what you did?
When I joined the Army, I didn't know what I was going to be faced with. I knew that it was going to be a job to be done, and I would do whatever I was told to do. So knowing that you're willing to go in and do something, not knowing exactly what kind of work you're going to do or what kind of rewards you're going to get, we didn't expect any rewards at all. Nice to be known that you're treated as a regular veteran. And we didn't expect that when we joined. We were just joining for the duration of the war, and that was it, with no future plans for anything after the war. Just get the war over and get the guys home was the main thing.
And now you've lived all these years since. You're 93 going on 94. You've got kids and grandkids and great-grandkids. What would you say that you're most thankful for?
Well, I look back and think that it was a privilege to get to join the service. Everybody doesn't get to do that, and it was a privilege to know that you joined and you did something worthwhile. You contributed your share of the effort. And that was, I look back on many things and think that I was rewarded, that I was accepted in the Army, and was they accept me and provided for my care. And it was really a good feeling to know that I had the privilege of serving and doing something worthwhile.
Did you ever get in any trouble in the Army?
Heavens no. you wouldn't dare get in trouble. There was too much punishment. And of course, we had to hold the reputation of the women. We had to prove to them that we could do the job and we would not give them any static.
Is there anything I haven't asked you about that you would like to share about your time as a WAC? Were there some other dignitaries that you came across or famous folks that you rubbed shoulders with?
Well, being in New York quite a bit, we went to a nightclub one time, Coco Habana. People heard of that nightclub, I guess, and met Pearl Bailey, and she was so nice and so much a lot of fun. And then I was at a hospital in New Jersey, and I met Ruth Etheridge, which is Fred Waring's wife, and several of the Broadway stars, Ethel Merman, a few other people. They put on a skit in the hospital, and I was in the skit, so they put on the skit and directed it. And the meeting with those people was so nice. They tried to talk me into staying in New York City and going to school, learning to be an actress, which I didn't want to have no part of that. I wanted to come back to California. But I did meet those interesting people. Oh, and one morning when I was on duty in New York City, we had to go to the induction center every morning. And then we would get our assignment as where to be for the day. And that, we were there one morning when Frank Sinatra reported for the draft. He came in with bodyguards. And everybody laughed because we said, who's going to hurt him in here, you know? And one of them stayed with the car outside, and the other three stayed inside with him. So the girls in the office who were WACs said, sit on the bench. We'll get to you in a few minutes. So they put him on a bench in the hallway and let everybody in the building know that Frank Sinatra was in the building sitting on the bench. So everyone had a chance to walk down the hallway and look at him. And it was a big deal that day because we walked right in front of him. He sat there for a long time because the girls were letting everybody have a chance to look first before they processed him. Finally, he got up and one of his guards wanted to know, what was the problem? Why was it taking so long? And they said, this is in the Army. You just have to sit and wait now. You can't have things your way. And so he was a little bit unhappy because he had to wait so long. But it was nice to for us to walk by and say, we were in control, not him.
So you took a walk by yourself and winked at a young Frank Sinatra?
I walked, but I didn't wink. I just looked through the corner of my eye.
Well, I guess now we know why he needed the bodyguards. It was to fend off all the WACs who were ready to take a look at him.
We just looked, and that was all. We kept on walking.
And you didn't make him sing?
No, we just pretend like we didn't even know him. Another thrill that I had, I always had a desire to want to march in a parade in New York City, and I got to do that. We marched in a parade one time on Fifth Avenue in New York City, and that was great. And then we went to the Rockefeller Center, that Rockefeller Plaza, that where all the flags are around the upper level. And for 30 days, we went there every – this was pushing bonds at the time. We went to that Rockefeller Center, okay, went in the building, organized, marched around that facility, and took down the flags for the night and brought them in. We marched them in. And, of course, the public would all gather and watch us do that every night. And I was real thrilled to go to get – those were state flags around there. And so I always took down the Iowa state flag because that was my home state where I was born. And that was a real kind of a thrill to know that when I see things going there on New Year's Eve and all, where the ice skating goes on, to think that I know exactly where I stood, which flag I took down. That was nice to know.
And the Glenn Miller thing, you were actually on stage. Did you have to dance or just stand there and smile or what?
Actually, we were on a riser behind the band on the stage. It was in a regular theater. It wasn't a dance hall. So there was the audience, the regular audience. The band was on the stage. Behind the band, on the back of the stage, was this raised, elevated area. And there were people sitting there, all branches of the service. And I represented the Women's Army Corps. Then it was strictly a bond rally to sell bonds. And that was a real thrill to... I wanted to get down and dance, but I had to sit still and not move.
And since we're talking about Glenn Miller, and I'm curious, when you heard the news that his plane had disappeared and that he was presumed dead, did that hit you kind of hard because of what his music had meant and your little personal run-in with him?
Not only me, but everybody that I know of all were very, very upset over that. We listened closely to the news for days, hoping they would find his plane and find him alive, and they never have it. And it was very, very sad because we... loved his music. It was good, danceable music. We all danced to that. But that's one thing we got to do in the Army. We could still dance.
Well, another thing that it occurs to me I ought to ask you. Here you are. The Army's taking you all over the place. You're experiencing big city life in New York. A girl who grew up in Iowa, then spent her formative years in Fresno, and you're getting a taste of the high life in New York City and rubbing shoulders with all these celebrities. What made you... so determined to come back and live in Fresno? What was so special about the San Joaquin Valley that sucked you back over here like a magnet.
Oh, it had so many advantages that the other areas did not have. And I visited almost all but seven states in the United States. And I said, I'm going back to Fresno. And they said, why, for heaven's sakes, where in the H is Fresno? And I said, well, we can get in the car in an hour or two. We're in the mountains. In the summertime, it's mountain resort areas. In the winter, it's snowing and skiing. Or we can get in the car and drive an hour or two and be on the ocean and be on the beach. We could go to San Francisco or Los Angeles if we wanted a big city. California had everything to offer that the other states didn't have that I thought, or things that I liked and enjoyed. So I said, of course, Fresno was home too, so it was nice to come back.
And I don't hear an ounce of regret in your voice when you talk about that decision to come back and make the valley your home again.
No way. My husband was a Kansas farm boy, and he went with me to California. I said, we're going to live. I won't get married you unless we can live in California. So we came back to California. And I don't regret one day that I spent in the Army. It was very, very rewarding. And I just felt like I was a fuller, nicer person for having served in that Army. Because it was another whole way of life. Someone said, well, it's a big adjustment to live a different type of life. And I said, well, they kept us so busy, we didn't have time to think about adjusting. You just did what you had to do, period.
Is there anything else you want to share with us that you think people ought to know about your time in the WAC?
Well, we don't want any recognition or any glory. We weren't doing that. We weren't heroes. We just did our job, and we just want other people to be willing to sacrifice, if you call it a sacrifice, to do anything to keep their way of life, preserve their way of life. In other words, live a good moral life, and you can't beat that. Support the veterans, especially those in the today. I have a son that's a Vietnam veteran and who is now 100% disabled, and I would say support these men that come back with problems and understand that it wasn't easy for them, and it isn't easy for anybody. But the Vietnam soldiers did not get respect when they came back, if most people remember. And I thought it was a shame because my son dropped out of college to join our service to go over to Vietnam. And I think that just show them the respect that they earned.
Amen. I know we're running short on time, and no one would mistake you for a Doolittle Raider. They just marked the 70th anniversary of that incredible mission, by the way. But Hilda, you had a different kind of B-25 adventure.
We could never wear slacks. We had to wear skirts at all times. So I used to hitchhike on military planes to go from New York to California on a leave. And I was in San Francisco one time, and I asked for a pilot if I could ride in his plane. It was a B-25. And he said, yes, but he looked and he said, do you have any slacks you could wear? And I said, I got a pair with me because I knew that I had to wear slacks on the plane. They wouldn't let us get on with a skirt on. And so I put the slacks on. I took my jacket off and hung it up where the MP couldn't see it. And they would see me, and they'd ask me if I was in the Army. And I would say, I didn't say no, but I'd say, what do you mean, Army? And so then they ignored me because I was out of uniform. But when I rode in the B-25, that was the biggest thrill. I rode from San Francisco to Andrews Air Force Base in Washington, D.C., and part of the time I was in the co-pilot seat, which was no-no, but I was up there. They let me ride there. And then I rode in the nose of a B-25 bomber where the bomber sits. And from Fort Worth, Texas to Washington, D.C., I rode in the nose of that plane. It was fabulous going through the air, seeing everything with plexiglass dome. We went through a rainstorm. The dome was leaking, and our cushion was a parachute. And I said to myself, if I had to jump out of this plane, I don't know how to put the parachute on. I wouldn't know how to open it. Besides, it wouldn't matter because it was sitting in water anyway, and it probably wouldn't. So I said, well, if the plane crashes, it crashes, you know. I'm just going to enjoy the view. And then we saw storm clouds overhead, and the pilot called on the radio and said, I'm going under those clouds. Don't be alarmed. And we went at a 45-degree angle down to treetop height. And that was fabulous, sitting in this plexiglass dome with the whole plane behind you. And then we went over an area that was all marked red on a map. And the pilot said, I have to go around that red area. Then we found out later that was Tennessee, Oak Ridge, Tennessee, where they were building the atomic bomb. And that was why the military planes couldn't even fly over that area. We had to go around it. But that was the biggest thrill, riding in the nose of that B-25 bomber across the country. It was fabulous.
Sounds like your life would have been a lot less exciting if you had never joined the military.
That's true. That's true. So that's why I said I don't regret that I have had a fabulous time.
You've told us how much of an adventure your time in the service was, but it also was exhausting at one point. You had to go into the hospital because you wiped yourself out.
Well, it was after my 30 days temporary duty in New York City. We went out and saw the town every other night, And on the opposite nights, we had to be on duty somewhere for public relations. And then we had to be a reporter the next morning at 7:30 in the morning. So I had about 4 hours sleep for 30 days, and I passed out with physical exhaustion, was in the hospital for a month trying to figure out what was wrong with me. They finally decided I burned the candle at both ends, and that doesn't work. But that was a fascinating experience, being in the hospital. I'll never forget one episode there, which was kind of sad. We woke up one morning, and the nurses came in and told us that during the night they had brought back the nurses from Corregidor, those who had been prisoners of war by the Japanese in Corregidor. They brought the nurses in during the night, put them in a ward, all of them, and they told us, now don't talk to these ladies at all. Don't stop and even look at them. Just walk by their door because we had to pass their door to go get our breakfast. And they said, do not talk to them. The government wants to debrief them before you talk to them. So we walked by their door, and they were standing staring into space just like they were hypnotized or something. They were obviously, a couple of them were pregnant, and mentally they were just stunned. They were just standing staring into space, and we felt so sorry for them because they had really suffered. And we walked by, we would just smile and say good morning and keep on walking real fast, and they wouldn't let us talk to them. But I never will forget that, because that was one of the horrible things that did happen to some of the women during the war. Of course, these were all nurses that were there in the early part of the war. But that was one thing that I'll never forget.
Well, it's pretty clear that even at age 93, there are a lot of things you haven't forgotten. And you've helped us remember the role women played in World War II. Thank you, Hilda. If you want to meet this special woman, come see us at Carrington Point next Saturday. KMJ is going to be broadcasting live from 7 to 2 next Saturday, May 19th. Don't forget to make it a special day for the moms in your life tomorrow, and join us again next Saturday for another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.